afternoon, is that we return to the curate the conversation that we began to have. And we kind of look at what sort of outcome we might like to have for today. In a sense, considering that all of us who are in this room are actually multiply connected. And if we could put a frame around it, suggesting that what we're really talking about is not so much, although we want to refer to how practically, what practical issues of archiving are, that really, as we're certainly here, a partnership of research projects and centres, that we really talk about what kind of opportunities research, a spatialised notion, if you like, of research offers us to really think about how we're able to experiment with and run projects that take forward our knowledge and how we transfer that knowledge. So we've got examples of practical projects in archiving from many different fields, and the particular project of Lux Online seems to be one that we really need to kind of keep in mind all the time. But I think bringing those ideas about how we might partner, how we might collaborate, what our needs are, but also what we have to offer into the research space would be a really useful place for us to go. Maybe that's extremely speculative at this point, and we might decide that some of the things that we would need to do or we would want to do would be to have other kinds of events, for instance, that push research forward. And we've all been involved in those kinds of events, but that's fine. We also think about that as well. We've already had several ideas over lunch. So let's kind of, it's always a little bit difficult to return to a conversation after the sort of dynamic has started to disperse over other kinds of conversations and a few sandwiches. But I'm sure, like everybody else, you know, I made a huge number of notes on this morning. And just want to kind of return us to that idea that there are a number actually of very, very interesting kinds of tensions and discussions in the area of a kind of research around archives. One of the most important, I think, being the relationship between user-generated and curated work, and the whole notion of what it means to really curate archives. And those are all issues about, if you like, authority, preservation, access, usability, networking, collaboration. And shall I open the discussion there? And some people are kind of nodding. And I'm going to refer to Campbell on my right here and say, would you like to kind of suggest anything, any trajectories, if you like, of where that goes? Having started this morning.
I think we're in a really interesting time at the moment where we still have the memory of analog and physical, and we're moving into kind of digital spaces and virtual spaces. And so at that point, there are going to be tensions. And we're also at the interface of people having a memory of print, and print being quite static, you know, how information is, and the web being quite static for a while. And some sites are still static to a dynamic web, and the web where the user can interact with the interface and change stuff. So in a way, I mean, I haven't got any answers, just observations to say that will have its own tensions. And then, you know, you have, as you said, the thing about the institution and the artist, sometimes their goals are very different to the people who come. What did you call them? The public, we would call them users, you call them the public.
Well, it's interesting, so, in a way, because the public already seems almost like a slightly old-fashioned notion, of mass, whereas the notion of the user is in more informal.
At some point you have to take a stand, and it probably depends on politics, economics, you know, philosophy, and all those things, and I can't answer that. I can just go on where we are at Lux.
I mean, there were a couple of things that came out of your presentation that these are just sort of observations that I thought. But I thought this idea of the wisdom of crowds that you mentioned was kind of interesting, because the first question is, how big is a crowd? What constitutes a crowd? I mean, in a way, I went to this, there's this thing, this conference of the weekend called Film Mobile, which was about people delivering, making work for mobile phones and mobile devices, iPods and so on. And somebody, and I can't remember who it was, but talked about how in the early days of when the generation of content for these devices was assumed, and on the web, was assumed to be kind of under much more sort of corporate control. People were talking about the idea of creating, and I can't remember the exact numbers, but this will do, 16 channels with 1 million users each. And his point was that the actual reality of that is that there are 1 million channels with 16 users each. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of, it's turning over the Warholian idea of everybody being, in the future everybody will be famous for 15 minutes, they're actually be famous for 15 people. You know, it's that kind of, what constitutes an audience and what constitutes a group of users in that kind of context. That's just a kind of observation, but I think in terms of what we think about as our kind of various constituencies of users and researchers and audiences or whoever they might be, these are kind of interesting issues, because they point to no longer can we think of an audience as, you know, it's like the old television model when in the 70s that you might have had the majority of the population were watching one of two or three channels on television. Now there's, 40 on Freeview and God knows how many more, and then there's the web, and then there's this. So is this kind of multiplicity of interest groups is it kind of interests me, and in a sense we're almost like a kind of microcosm of that here in terms of our own kind of particular backgrounds. That's just an observation, but one that might...
Well, what I've going towards that is, let's use an example of Google or Blip or YouTube, and the numbers that I think it's like 52 million people are using YouTube, yeah?
Yeah.
And the wisdom of that crowd is that Leave Britney Alone is the most popular, that randomly comes.
Yeah.
That is what YouTube presents, or Bikini Girl.
Yeah.
So that becomes their wisdom. And it's totally on curated. There's no curatorial policy in YouTube. It's just anybody can do it. For Lux, we curate it, but we don't control who watches what. So we look at our stats to see who's the most popular artist per month. But that is only from who we've added. It's not who's the most popular artist in the world. It's who's the most popular artist from who we've put on the site.
Yes.
And the factors vary to people having exhibitions on, or there being a song associated with it, with an artist who has a tour. Do you see what I'm saying? It's...
And what
moves like
and
that.
And what that's suggesting is that there is this kind of multiplicity of groups. There is no longer the notion I suppose we can talk about a mainstream in a sense, and that might be represented in terms of online by things like MySpace and YouTube and so on, but there are much smaller groups as well.
Yes.
And that's just a kind of observation, just mapping out in a sense what the sort of territory that we're talking about looks like.
Yes.
And the art world is a kind of replicates that in its own way. You've got everything from large institutions like Tate and smaller galleries that represent the interests of individual artists and who have very strong and quite often economic interests in protecting copyright and protecting notions of ownerships and the individual as the default unit of production of work and so on. And then you have the artists that are uploading videos under Creative Commons licenses to the Internet Archive and Our Media and things like that.
Yeah.
And in a sense, in terms of artist moving image world, which is the world that we inhabit.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the span. You go from what the more kind of anarchic kind of attitude towards it, which has a kind of political impetus of information wanting to be free,
and, yeah.
To people who don't want their work on the web because they still they're in this what I might even kind of provocatively call a kind of 19th century mindset of the individual artist, you know. And then there are people who work online collaboratively without sort of the notion of the individual author anymore. So, but this is our territory, I think. This is what we're kind of looking at, in a sense. There's no, that's just a kind of way of encapsulating it. Really.
I'm wondering where the research question. Terrible, actually, because I was research on my brain. In a way, where the research is, and one of the things that's really come out to me today, and it's a very, very interesting thing, is that, in fact, we've moved the discussion away from talking about the content. We actually all have a fairly clear idea of responsibility towards the content, towards what artists do. That may happen and may be mediated in multiple ways. But what we're talking about is the way that art organises, and actually the potential for research around ideas about association and affinity and exchange and collaboration and networking. And in fact, artists have always done.
Yeah.
Artists have always created very significant and important kinds of associative relationships, relational fields really, that are sometimes genre-based and sometimes based on who you know and who you want to know. It seems to me that the wisdom of crowds isn't to do with content at all, it's to do with organisation.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I kind of think, that's a place where research can really happen. So it's not really to do with researching how you get the work up. The intellectual research is around much more, you brought in the A.B. Warburg idea, but the idea of what it is that this kind of hive, the archive, the network, the cell structure, whatever it is actually doing. That seems to me to be a really interesting interaction there that could research.
But a kind of topic for research, which I think would be interesting, is the issues that, I don't remember your name, Martin, and you raised about what is worthy, the measurement of worthiness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, is it because it's no longer accessible, just that whole notion, which I don't think is often addressed. People sort of do it and then are afraid because it brings up a whole can of worms. You know what I mean?
Interesting enough, we were just saying over lunch, do you have to die to then be recognised as worthy?
Yeah. That's what we've already been talking about. Haven't found a way to curate, in a sense. In a really generous way, incredibly important discussion for our time, because the archive is partly about dealing with death. So that's a very, very, very good question.
We tried asking people what they wanted to see from our archive, and then it led to the question, "What do you have?" We didn't know. We said we might have some like early David Blandy. Because we want to see that. So it's kind of what we suggested was what people wanted to see. It wasn't really a dialogue between people wanting to look at this inaccessible material and us providing it. It's kind of, we were still choosing it. Sure. It didn't really resolve the problem. What do we do with that?
In a sense, what you're saying is that a lot of the kind of gatekeeping work has already been done as well by
it was done
historically.
It was done at the time it was
also,
chosen.
Yeah.
And then it's like, there's no order to it, it's just in boxes, on shelves.
Yeah.
It's kind of essentially looking at them, recognising a name and saying, you've got this.
Yeah. But I mean, it's the amount of times that people come into the study collection and say, they want to look at a certain type of work and they're interested in work by this particular artist, whereas they might be hucked up another artist that have worked in that area with those subjects that are equally kind of worthy in the sense of their the value of their work and the interest. I mean, I think that in terms of my kind of presentation and the relationship to Warburg and so on is the importance of opening up the realm of possible resources and material that is available to. I mean, I'm thinking of this from the point of view of an artist researcher, a practice-based researcher. So not necessarily looking for the most the most valuable works of art as in terms of their artistic quality or artistic merit, but material that is of interest because of other qualitative questions about the subject or their contents and so on. So in a sense, it's a way of kind of bringing these two things together, this notion of worthiness and this notion of the relevance of material to the practice and to the practice of research and being non-kind of hierarchical about it.
There's a subtle point Campbell made earlier, which was the artists who do make the work accessible are the ones that then get talked about because it's there, it's easy to access. It's kind of just...
It's counterintuitive, isn't it? I mean, that's what's been going on with web for a long time. There's a counterintuitive understanding now that you make a work free, and in fact that generates another economy. If you hold the work back, then that doesn't necessarily add value. Sometimes it does. But that's, in a sense, one of those, that is part of the research into value. Actually finding a way to even curate the notion of how you research into value in those terms, think about what terms of reference you use to research value, I think is a very interesting question. Which is really John Oswald's kind of intellectual creation.
Yeah.
People really know, he's a Canadian record producer. He's done a lot of intellectual work on the whole notion of piracy. And a lot of that sort of, if you like, cross-disciplinary intellectual work has been done within music as well. We could also draw from, in fact. So sound and language, and actually language poetry, and Ken Goldsmith, the founder of Ubu. He's, again, been an incredibly important figure in looking at alternative modes of association. Could be part of that circulation around, I think, questions of value, but questions of organisation. So I'm not being very articulate, but I'm just...
Yeah, I mean, I think the equation you're talking about is the kind of... There is one notion of value that is where things acquire value through scarcity. Whereas the online version you're talking about is their proliferation gives them value.
And
that's the counterintuitive kind of equation. So in a sense, I mean, you could characterize the scarcity model as being the old model, the old art world model is the unique object, whereas the new online model is kind of away from the notion of, again, I come back to this term, but the individual artist practitioner. And I mean, I think that's the kind of tension of the moment, in a sense, or has been the tension of the moment for a while now.
But maybe the two things are also coexistent. And there's another very interesting New York publisher, Steve Clay, who publishes artist books, who wrote a really good book on the history of poetry on the Lower East Side. And one of the things that he talked about is that when a technology is surpassed, it becomes available to artists. So the typewriter becomes available to artists, and the supercomputer becomes available to artists. And, you know, every surpassed technology has an aura, in fact, in a sense, in the end. And the book becomes an artifact available to artists once it stops being the form of mass production that we get most of our information from. So in a sense, another area of research might be to do with the relationship between those things, to do with the unique individual artifact and the endlessly reproducible and changeable material. They're not actually in opposition. They're in a dialectical relationship, aren't they? I mean, there's a, you know, there's that whole Marxist thing where the subject produces its object, and the object produces its subject, and the web produces a new subject all the time, or a new object. Anyway.
And that's an interesting conversation in terms of artist film video.
It is.
At a point where, you know, film as a medium, as a, you know, as a material medium, is you're more likely to find it in an art gallery now than you are in a cinema.
Yeah.
And in a sense, it's become, for cinema, film has become obsolete. It's all digital now. You go to the Odeon, you'll see a digital projection, you won't see film. But you go down to White Cube and you'll see, you know, Runa Islam or someone showing a 35mm film. Which is that same, it's become obsolete in sort of mainstream, it's become taken up by artists, which is, I think, is a different kind of use to the sort of the old co-op model of distribution, and has now taken on that kind of scarcity value.
But Pat and I were talking over lunchtime, and Molly and I, about whether I've been rather interested for a while in setting up a series of talks called Talking in the Library, and, you know, thinking about ways in which artists have engaged, for instance, with the printed book or the archive or the catalogue. And again, there's sort of modes of cultural spaces that have, you know, that have authority, that have curation, that have value of a certain kind that artists' research may enter into. And, you know, in thinking about archival tools, when we're not thinking about archives in a reductive way, we're trying to think about them as the poetics of the archive, aren't we? A way in which we enable practice-based research, collaborative practice-based research, through inflected tools, if you like. They're not transparent tools, whereas certain kinds of institutions, like our own being one, may like to see them as uninflected tools, as cardboard boxes where you put stuff. And Andrew and I were talking about the resistance of people to the repository, apart from the name. And I think partly it is that we're seeing it as an uninflected cardboard box, aren't we? Where there's organised research into how we engage with archives might actually even help us to have more sense of ownership over that.
A cool research thing might be to create an experiential virtual world, a bit like Second Life, which is an archive, and see how people behave in that archive. So
that would be a test environment.
Second Life archive.
But you know what I mean? To see, because you can't really study it and measure it if it's there unless you have a camera and watch people.
Yeah.
But then watch people's behaviour in terms of what boxes they might open. Do they open boxes because they're labelled or not labelled, or if they've heard of the artist or not, you know, and to see.
And has it been done, though? It sounds such a good idea.
Don't know. They've done so many things in Second Life. You know, but it will be a research project in itself that will be created using tools already available, immersive tools that somebody can program and then.
I mean, it is interesting, that behaviour thing, because I know with the Archives Collection Centre in the Stanley Kubrick Archive, I remember having a conversation with Sarah, who manages that, and saying how we planned it in a particular way. And one of my early conversations with her after it was, people don't behave in the way we expected.
That's very interesting.
They work in groups, they're noisy, you know, you have this image of people working in the archives with white gloves on, very silent, very intense, and actually, because there were lots of people using it that were doing creative works as a result of it, it was actually very buzzy and very noisy and very group intimate and interactive in a really exciting way. And I thought, I had to kind of pinch myself and say, all these assumptions that you have, and,
exactly.
They're very,
and then we design spaces to close down possibilities rather than open them up.
Yeah.
There's very, I remember my husband's a book researcher, works on the history of libraries, and he's done a huge amount of research on the Bible, and He did all this research about what Renaissance users did with their Bibles. Mm. And so you'd think that what they did with their Bibles was, you know, handle them with white gloves. And no, of course they didn't. They let their children colour in, they cut bits out of them, they wrote recipes in them, they did cut and paste all over them. They did things that we think are terrible. A group of nuns took an you probably know that, took a little giving to these incredibly important, valuable Bibles, and they cut them all up. And then they read.
A performance piece in itself.
And they did collage with them, which nobody was supposed to do before the 20th century. You know, people do terrible things.
To sacred objects.
And of course, we view the past as being a place where they all did the right thing with books. Of course, they didn't. So in a way, I think perhaps there's something to learn. And I'm also interested in what we might learn from other disciplines. And some of those disciplines about book history, for instance, have shown that rather than people attending to print and silent reading, they did all kinds of stuff with their books. And they wrote all over them.
Yeah.
And they didn't care. So I think, in a way, that's back to our thing about, well, maybe we need to make access for the noisy, disruptive.
Yes, we need to, it's almost a sense of saying we need to wake the archives up.
Yeah.
You know, instead of the kind of, the sort of approach of warehousing, which is just shoving stuff in carbon boxes and putting it somewhere. Well, we need to get people in there.
This is where, you know, in terms of the digital has a role to play, doesn't it, in terms of...
Well, that's, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And what you're showing and kind of putting, you know, the way that you were putting works side by side, so, you know, you need a space where you can experiment and move things around, but you do have to protect the actual original object in some cases, but actually that's your place for experimentation.
I mean, maybe this, in a sense, this is a key, that the, you know, the digital is kind of transient and can be messed around with without actually doing any harm to the physical object, the original object. So there is that kind of relationship between the two, between what we might call the virtual and the physical and the analog. So perhaps the interests are not, you know, there are mutual interests in doing this, which is kind of an interesting way of pursuing this idea, perhaps.
Is there a word?
Well, I mean, of course, intellectual property then becomes something else. But
I'm just thinking about the listening to this, thinking, well, if there's going to be research in this area, lots of possibilities seem to be surfacing. I've been wondering in which directions the researchers would be posing their research questions. You know, I mean, if it's just the practical business of writing a grant application, you're aiming at somebody, trying to impress them with the importance of this. And I was wondering where those applications would go, in a sense, and who you'd be appealing to. Some of us seem to be talking sometimes about archival studies as a research area.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a panel of the HRC, isn't there, which is about librarianship and archival information science and stuff. And I guess that's about the sorts of things we've just been talking about, is that how people, you know, how should an archive be organised? What don't we know about the way they're used? What don't we know about the way, about the people who don't come, do come, and so on? Those sorts of questions. So you'd further knowledge about the nature and value of archives by asking those questions and getting them answered. But then there's a whole lot of other things which we've come across today, which, where the archive is, as it were, the setting, or it supplies the materials which researchers who are asking quite different questions, actually. I mean, if you think of creative art practitioners, we heard this morning that they might exploit an archive to create a work of art which would be life-enhancing and make people think or move them or whatever. And they're using archival material from that, whereas they could be painting a landscape, but they're using archival material. And now, any questions in that area would be asked using completely different language to a completely different target audience.
And that's only two, and I suspect there may be a few other sectors, actually. I mean, there's the whole there's the whole resource enhancement business, which has now gone off the funding map, which is about, instead of having everybody hauled down to an archive to see the unique object, let's digitise the whole thing, then anybody can look at it anywhere, and the original object won't be damaged. And that's a whole other third. Now, that is saying that this archive is important for another group. It's all about the history of the Mini, and if you're a person who's a historian of cars, you need to get access to that archive, and you can't, so we will make it possible for you. So there's a lot of different...
Yeah, but there's another way of thinking about it. If you think about it through practice-based research, for instance, then maybe you can use your first example of the organisation of the archive in a sort of critically reflected way. So one would think that archival studies might use a science or a social science-based approach to do testing. But with Campbell's model, you might be using the way in which art thinks to do the testing, as well as it being the subject. So that subject-object relationship, if you like. So you're not splitting the resource, the materials for artists to make new work from the way in which it's organised. And I'm wondering whether that is the most interesting thing to think about. You've got, that seems to me to be the thing I'm beginning, because I've been thinking about this in other contexts, that practice-based research offers something rather dialectical. So you're, if artists critically reflect on the discipline of archival studies or the tools, it's really different than if social scientists use those tools and then artists take the tools and make new work. But we haven't got to that stage in research yet, certainly not with the AHRC.
Well, no, one of the reasons, I guess, is that that's, I suspect, a particularly challenging kind of interdisciplinary mix, isn't it?
It is, but it seems
just
to be
something...
Just
on the institutional level of where you send your bid or something. I mean, it's their that's their problem to sort that out, but...
But isn't it there in theory?
Get those people together.
I mean, if you thought, I mean, it sounds very kind of terribly highfalutin to say, to talk about Derrida or something, but you sort of looked at, took archive fever, or you you took... you know, the new archaeology, for instance, which is engaging with performance, and then I start to say, yes, but there are intellectuals out here who've been and looking at the history and the nature of archives, the nature of discipline. Can we use that to inform that? Because on one level, being very intellectual, we expect people to be scholarly, and then another level, we're dealing with things like, you know, very boxy categories.
Yes, but you always have to tick these boxes about where your application is going.
Yes,
that's, that's what I was thinking of when I posed those questions.
No, I totally agree with you. And I don't. I mean, what's the answer to that? Is it actually?
I think you just suggested it, which is as it were to send it in a particular direction, but be unabashed about posing that recipient source with the challenge of understanding your complex approach.
Is it also partly to do with something I'm also rather interested in at the moment, gaining cultural clout by gathering together in a more generously collaborative way, so that we're saying not just this is what I happen to think, but actually, you know what we think? We would like to approach things in this way. We represent numbers of different kinds of approaches and institutional stakes or personal stakes. But actually, we're all interested in this, and actually, we'd, you know, we'd like to put an application together, because that seems to me to be one way of approaching things, to be genuinely collaborative.
Especially if your application is saying this is the beginning of a journey and we're not sure where it's going to end.
It's speculative.
Yeah.
You need to have some people just mulling things over.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more difficult if you go for a research grant where you're meant to know what the context is, and you're meant to know precisely what the big question, even what the outcome probably going to be, and we really don't, I don't think.
We don't. But
so
we,
it's network or workshop or something, isn't it?
But we are allowed to not know. I mean, Slade Phila de Waal has been trying to put forward, I think she's got an interesting research model, open-ended research that doesn't know what its outcomes are.
She's
much more process-based.
She's got
she did
get an AHRC grant to look at that.
She did,
I'm not entirely sure what she's doing.
Yeah, I think she has.
Okay. is our own expectation of being able to see this material without too much effort. Mm. Mm.
Well, that's the wisdom of crowds,
in a
sense,
isn't it?
Or the
laziness of the
wisdom of the lot.
But it also opens up international mm-hmm. usage, which is just some, you know, just something that you can never underestimate. And even, you know, within the country, a lot of things are, there's a wealth of material in London, but if you lived in Scotland or, you know, or in Wales or wherever, do you know what I mean? How do you access it? Do you have to take a train or something? It takes time.
And the other thing we should reflect on is it not the case that the archivists would tell us that if you digitise material, it doesn't reduce the numbers of requests to see the original?
Yeah.
Because so many people get to see it
potentially
on the web,
yeah.
they all get fascinated and want to come and see the,
exactly.
the real thing.
Exactly.
So.
Yes. But it
which
but
is good, you
yeah.
know, because
yeah.
we're there to show them the real thing, but doesn't make it cheaper or safer or safeguard its life.
No, not in any way. But I still keep coming back to thinking about what does artists' practice-based research offer to those questions? Intellectually informed practice-based research, so that it's not seen just within a socio-economic model that we are already accepting, but it's finding different ways to see.
And I think that whole thing about the language, you know, how you interrogate an archive, because we traditionally presume people interrogate it through the use of words and what have you, but actually, that,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
And you showed some of that this morning,
yes.
you know, it may be that people, you know,
yeah.
there are other ways and more meaningful ways that a visual artist then want to interrogate works, but how do we deal with that?
I was just thinking of the use of the word interrogate.
I'm just thinking, I mean, that just to broaden this, to consider the way Patrick Keeler worked with the National Film Archive and the Mitchell McKinnon Collective through a AHRC fellowship at the Royal College of Art. I mean, I'm just throwing this in because we're talking about. I have no idea how the actual ins and outs of the actual applications, but did he know what he was doing when he applied for it? Does anyone know?
You
know, but there were some very interesting
make an archive of applications?
Outcomes from it in a number of ways, I mean, including a kind of geographical and the idea of a journey.
Yeah.
Mm.
And which, you know, also became a physical exhibition at the National, the NFT, BFSL. I'm just saying that, what I mean, I'm not an authority on this, but he might be someone that could be consulted.
Yes.
I mean, another National Archive that happens to be film, whether they want something to do with the National Archive, such as Tate, they could learn something from that.
So good, but it's such a good example for this because, in a way, I remember people at BFI saying he really challenged their kind of categorization of their documentation about the Mitchell and Kenyon collection. That his interest in it kind of went through that completely, sort of at an angle, at a tangent.
So he's actually doing that research we were talking about, crossing disciplines. He's addressing the function and the form of the archive as well as taking the material. And actually picking four instances of artists' work in different disciplines that then pertains or offers experimental models is another very interesting piece of necessary research. It doesn't have to be in film. I mean, the Abby Warburg example is not, but there are many examples of ways in which an artist can take materials and...
But it's also overturning, as Dave just sort of suggested, the whole idea of the archive anyway, and how archivists think of their archive,
mm-hmm.
which which isn't to say they're wrong or anything, it's just that you can come in at a different, in England, with a different, which is much the same as what the artist placement group.
And so there are really important fundamental way markers of how to act, if you like, of models that are not just to do with artists. I mean, the Artist Placement Group is an example of an organisational model where the artist is also creating a new organisational model, isn't it? As well as basically.
Yes, I mean that's what we hope to get funding for.
Yeah.
It's a project which will bring an artist into the archive, to sit alongside an archivist who will be going through the archive of an art organisation, which the artist himself is, as it were, an heir to in his own practice.
Yeah.
So, and the organisation, of course, is about the placement of artists in organisations. So, he's going to be placed in the Tate Archive, looking at the archive of the Artist Placement Group.
Yeah.
And so you can see how complex it was trying to describe what were going to be the outcomes of this, because the archive will be dealt with professionally and become, as it were, available with sort of bog standard archival kind of job, a new resource made available. But then he will be learning, but also informing the practice and also informing the practice of the archivist as a kind of consultant specialist. And then what we hope to do also, if we get this money, is that we will then put him and the material in the galleries so that we can have a display on the Artist Placement Group as a historical phenomenon, but the display won't be a purely historical one because it'll be him and his board of his successor organisation having their meetings in the middle of Tate Britain. So Tate Britain aren't quite sure how they're going to cope with this, but I mean that's good.
So will the artists make work as well, reflecting the
art? Yeah, well, the artist's work is going to be the blogging and recording that he's going to be doing of his of that experience, and then also, as it were, the installation that he will make of the office of experiments.
So he's wrapping that. And that's going through Chelsea, I think, is it? It's gone through Chelsea.
Chelsea's involved in it, and Neil White is the artist, and his other AGI, Bournemouth, he's associated with them. So there's a lot of people involved in it.
That's right.
It's the whole point about APG when they went into an organisation was... we cannot guarantee what the outcome is going to be.
Yeah, that's right.
So it was always...
That's why that was such
an important part of it.
Completely.
That you could not dictate at the outset that a film would come out of that placement or an artwork would come out of that.
Yes.
It was a process-based thing.
Yes. And for very good reasons, the objective may change in the course of it.
Yeah.
And so that's what made the writing of this application quite a challenge, because, of course, the people funding are completely wedded to clear outcomes, and so we had to find ways of...
Although they say that they're completely wedded not to outcomes, but to process.
Yeah, but we know from our experience on the panels it's much tougher to say yes or no if you're judging those applications, if the outcomes aren't clear somehow. Because you then can't so easily answer the question about, does this represent value for money? Because if you can't see what's going to come out, it's really hard to answer that one.
It seems to me that in a sense, we're having a speculative discussion here in a sense, but one of the things that we might be saying is, are there rather different kinds of outcomes that come out of a particular sort of process? In other words, that knowledge transfer may be rather different from a book or a film,
influence the network transfer of knowledge throughout us.
Yes. And of course, if you change your mind, it then looks like you don't know what you're doing. That's the problem. And that's what's so intellectually constraining about those bureaucratized grant awarding systems.
And that's where APG was kind of antithetical to all of that, because at the end of the day, they were sort of saying, but weren't, trust me, I'm an artist.
Yeah.
And there will be something at the end, and I'm just not prepared to
Yeah, I mean, actually, see, that Tate was completely happy with that. Because it spends time commissioning artists, and so that bit of it wasn't a problem. It was the AHRC.
Well, the AHRC, because I've just been reading their guidelines again, does say that, you know, it's absolutely fine if there's no research process involved and you're just commissioning artists, and of course in that case there'll be ineligible for funding.
Yes.
Oh, right, okay.
And, yes. And Nigel, just this work that Neil's doing, would that work, whatever the outcome is, which is a piece of work of some description, will that then go into the archive itself? Will it be collected by the archive?
Yes, it's going to be, that kind of it's going to be a digital work, which will be then, it's going to be initially be done down at Bournemouth, and then it's going to come into the Tate's collection and be maintained.
Mm. One of the things that does is to give a research context to future work. So it also says this is an instance of work in which the artist's work is organisational.
Yes.
It creates an organisation and it creates this digital work. Therefore, other work can do this.
Mm. It also means that in 20 years' time, another artist can go back into the archive and do research into that in terms of kind of, yes. I like this kind of cyclical sort of.
We don't know whether we've got that. Money, yes.
Oh, okay.
But even if we haven't actually, it's been an extremely valuable process just trying to work out how you could possibly do that kind of thing. I mean, so many research projects are very straightforward in terms of their methodology, and this one wasn't, so it won't be completely wasted.
No, and I think Neil is someone we've got to work with as well.
Yeah, he just couldn't make it.
This project, and he has learned, ideas about how you do experimental testing.
Mm.
Working in labs, creating kind of cross-disciplinary laboratories for putting artists into situations.
And I think that the methodology is kind of at the centre of what we're talking about.
Yes, actually, it's methodological research that we're talking about to a certain extent, so that it needs to include methodology within it. Yeah. Yes. Mark, do you want me to introduce you?
No.
Mark Rash was going to, was always going to join us this afternoon, and is now listening at that. But Mark was very instrumental for in ICWA, actually, first of all, in actually getting the research centre that I now direct going, but also in really thinking about questions of archiving and the kinds of equipment, but also the methodologies that we might need to take this further. So. We moved on to conversation. So.
Okay.
I mean, can I just sort of pause there to go back to Andrew as somebody who came into this conversation in a sense rather late and from a slightly different perspective. But Andrew is someone who's been dealing with the university's cardboard box archive.
Yes.
Cardboard box digital archive. I've been listening to this conversation in terms of relationship of archives and research. What do you hear when you're hearing that?
No, I mean from the repository sort of side. I mean, as you say, what we're trying to do is what it's usually done. It has put it into boxes. Mm. Obviously, we're also talking of teaching and learning. Their whole thing is to be able to reuse all the material. Mm. So obviously, hopefully. Would have their people would be able to sort of do projects, do research based on how they actually access material. So it's obviously a big area, but it's trying to get people on board to actually see it as a valuable resource in itself. So that's sort of going on.
Where does that take you?
So that I want us to come out of this afternoon with a sense of what comes out is what comes out, but a sense of that collaborative work around archives that we may also be able to be part of and have something to offer to is useful, and thinking about where we might go or where on the most basic of levels what people might actually want. Molly and I were talking about the need that the Isaac Julian Studio has at the moment, just in terms of thinking about who to connect with, how to bring the archival work as a priority, how that might provide a model for the way in which artists work or other archives or so on. No, I think we need to kind of get some other ideas on the table. The one I've really got on the table at the moment is Second Life, which is an interesting one. I think it's a really interesting model.
I mean, there is something here, isn't there, about definitely the relationship of the artist with the archive in all different sorts of ways, as a contributor, as a user of art, as a generator of new work from. And for me, I suppose, the big question for me is about the dynamic creative role of the archive and how to make sure that archives are an empowering, enabling, creative force. And not about cardboard boxes, not about storage. Yeah. You know, I don't know, I mean, you have to have that as well, but the driver for me is about the dynamic aspects of what an archive can do.
Sorry, I am jumping in now. Have you talked about the training aspect earlier on? Because I was thinking as you were talking that one of the ways you develop these things is by run MAs to train for people who are specifically interested in working in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be, ideally you would have something which was of interest to both people in the fine arts field, but also...
Well, I think there's something before then, because I think training is, to me, is about imposing a particular behaviour. I think what's interesting here is actually we're trying to open things up rather than closing them. So I'm not sure what the right training would be now. I can, I know what training would be from an art perspective, but I fear, and this is why I think it's so exciting to be kind of having this conversation now, that we would narrow possibilities down in some ways, in a way. And I think this is about rethinking, remodelling,
Can you remodel the MA as a space? I mean, because I know that enters something else into the equation about how an educational institution works and how you educate future artist scholars or artist archivists. And is there a way, is that part of what you're saying?
Sort of what I'm saying, I mean, give you a concrete example. I mean, we run this curating course at the art college 13 or 14 years, and there's no archiving of the work of previous courses. In all the academic institutions I've been in, this one, University of the Arts, also University of East Anglia, there is very little in the way of any kind of self-reflection on the process of how you create an archive from out of your own practice, let alone this wider issue.
Yeah.
And we were trying to build it into our course structure, but unfortunately the library staff is too stressed to really help us out.
They're
just long.
There's such a lot there, because one of the things that's come out of today, and I think it's been a really interesting idea, and I'm very interested in this, so perhaps that's how I hear it, is how much we have to offer rather than how little we have to offer. So it seems to me that there has to be you have to have collaboration in order to release that capital, so that you're not asking very stressed staff to simply add a training element to the work, but that you're operating on a different economy. And it's something, again, that Campbell brought in, the difference between the analogue and the digital, a change of consciousness is also about an economy where you can be more wasteful, where there's not so much, or maybe Steve said that, more, where there's not so much scarcity, but you actually have a lot to offer.
That value not be served by scarcity.
Yeah, because this notion that we have no time to self-reflect.
In a way, one of the things we all have in common is our development of websites that, in theory, make our collections more accessible. And it strikes me that just a very simple thing that can come out of today is that we continue the conversation about what
what actually might be the priorities in the development of our websites, because they are this front line in terms of telling people what there is there, what we put on into this kind of virtual space that is available for people to plunder creatively straight away. So I think that's just something we could take out of today's is a continuing conversation about what we do with our websites and so on.
Well, what we do with digital space,
which is attached to our
how
websites,
we and how who we might want to join into that conversation.
Yeah.
And I don't want to lose that thing that Mark's just brought in about how you then create a conduit for education into the future of that, because if we expect artists to then be artist archivists, artist scholars, and interdisciplinary artists, who are sitting eventually on the AHRC, actually, by the way, and, because I was saying to Pat earlier, the strange thing about culture is it's actually only us. I mean, it's not that there's somebody else determining it, it's actually us determining it. So what would we like to do? I think that all of those things really come into it, but that we do need one or two very concrete things to work on, and I think that then that is one, how we negotiate web space. It's totally different. We've got a website at IGFAR which we need to redo, and I'm now just thinking, for a while I've been thinking, let's look by having one that's done with MySpace instead. And now I'm thinking, well, you know, there are ways of perhaps negotiating around that.
Just to put the tiny voice in, but the thing about websites is they're living, breathing things. They're not something you just put up and go, oh, I've got a website, that's it. You have to nurture them, and you have to add content constantly to them. They're not sort of there to be orphaned, because then they're no use to you or the people that come to you. One of the things you were saying about people being empowered by the archive and able to use it. I don't know, did you mean in terms of the physical archive or the virtual archive?
I think both. I mean, I think it's about, I think archives are very intimidating, and I suppose now I am thinking about physical, but they are very intimidating places, precious places. And actually, that's part of their joy, because people get very excited by that experience. But actually, in terms of for me, obviously there is a very, very profoundly important role of archives in terms of preservation. But for me, they don't have a value unless they generate new knowledge. They empower people to experiment and to move on. And it's about that kind of empowerment. I suspect that the digital environment allows for a greater level of empowerment. Whilst protecting the physical, so the two work together.
I'd say it probably depends on. I'm just looking at parallels between physical and virtual world. It's like the virtual world is, you know, if people can't use your website, they won't use it, and if you don't set it up to enable people not to have to learn your website, then they feel empowered to use it. And I would imagine it would be the same as the space. And I think when I think of a physical archive, I think of a dusty place with, like, you know, and like I can't go in there, know, because it's too precious to be touched, and not by me, by some little person that lives in there and then brings it out. You know what I mean? And so. But you know, that's in my imagination, and I'm sure it's in a lot of people's imagination. For a minute, I'll be like thinking I'm not going there. Even if I could, because I'd be thinking, oh, it's not for me, because I'm not. I'm not that person. So it's probably breaking that language barrier in a way, the language of usability or accessibility. It's like how you open it up, both physically and cognitively. In a way. So it's where it is, what it looks like, who's at the door, you know, how you're welcomed, you know, it's all the sort of things which then will empower.
It's interesting, because on the other extreme, we've got within our libraries what we call the touchy-feely collection. Collection, which are our materials and products, and Southampton Row here has one. And actually, the excitement you see in students' faces as they touch and feel things, that's a very different experience, and you see a very different relationship going on between objects, which ultimately could become archives, and the user, to the traditional experience that you've described of the traditional archive.
there's an essay actually by a historian called Carolyn Steedman called Dust, and it's about going to work in an archive and then going home to the bed and breakfast and getting sick from the dust. And then she relates that to a whole series of sort of theoretical ideas, but it's a brilliant idea that you literally do get sick. You're breathing in the dust of old skin and books and things like that. But some people just really, really like that very much. Mm-hmm. But to go back to what Mark was saying, because we don't have enough discussion about that, I think, and this notion of self-reflection, if you like, on process. I mean, Pat said that, you know, there's a sort of multiply inflected way in which we can look at how artists might engage with the archive. And there's also a need, in fact, something that we're not doing, perhaps, which is simply to reflect on our own processes, which we're not doing at all. And that's a very interesting question, that because actually we would all like to, for instance, often to see archives of artist process, but we're not reflecting on the processes that we use. Is that what you mean?
I was also thinking historically, because...
Yeah.
In part of the work of the artist film, Dave and Stephen's project here, has been to do the things that artists and filmmakers weren't doing, because artists and filmmakers were making work without thinking about, well, the future or how they're going to be preserved, and they were slashed under the bed or forgotten about because they'd moved on. And so it's only, I think, with the development of the digital media that people have become more conscious of it. So partly as we were talking, I was thinking, gosh, things have gone through such a big change now that you also have to talk a lot about forgetting. What do you want to get rid of?
Yes, absolutely.
Because there'll be far too much. I mean, now I suspect most moving image artists have probably got dozens of digital copies of cuts of their work on DVDs, one thing another, and it might be better for them all just to be thrown away and or just fix on the one and so on. So this, but that's more sort of historical reflection on what's happened in 50 years. But like you were saying, bringing that self-reflexivity into the training that goes on, the training of artists in art schools, I would say, for example.
Yeah.
How you learn about materials, how you learn about issues of conservation, because we don't teach that very much in undergrad or postgraduate education. We don't actually teach very much about the materials people are working with. It's assumed that stuff is permanent enough, and then 10 years down the line, we discover, oh, that's all gone. But how you actually go from this discussion to that, I think probably you need a bit more kind of reflection, as you're saying.
Yes, but I think it's a very important thing to kind of enter into the discussion. It is very strange that there are certain things that we have decoupled from our practice. We decoupled certain sorts of intellectual information about art history from our practice at the moment, and certain kinds of discussion about reflection on things like materials as well. And it does come back to the disciplines that we think are informing us. And as we discuss this, it's making me understand why there's been a huge amount of resistance from artists in this institution to putting their work into an institutional archive. Artists are simply not, in a sense, educated to be empowered to do that. And coming back to our sort of organisational methods, we can't just email people and expect them to do these things. So there is a whole series of kind of cultural empowerments that we probably really need to do here. And that's rather important. I mean, again, within book history, within history of print, I think one of the things that's happened is that the sort of textual and editing training that people have gone through has enabled them to address that theoretically as well, so that rather than just you know, the conservation studies has actually gone through a sort of very, very powerful, the thing they call the new editing, or the new rhetoric of editing, you turn people like Jerome McGowan and Johanna Drucker, where they have actually started to talk about versioning and the user and all sorts of things, and we're not quite there. I'm realising we're not there. We are, who are, you know, we're talking about that, but we're not there, and actually the other end of it, which is the education of future artists, is not quite where we're... We haven't brought that in yet.
Can I ask whether there's a professional body, I'm looking at you, as with within Archon, within the community of archivists, that concerns itself with the art archive? I mean, is it a is it an aspect of the professional practice of archive?
Well, certainly within the art libraries community, there's a visual...
Oh, it's ARLIS, is it?
Well, that's one, there's an interest area there where they combine visual art and archives. They've got a group there. But that's more of a... In terms of the Society of Archivists...
Well, those are the people who run those sorts of archives.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are... I want to say there's something that's really definite. So there's something there that's driving this area.
Because that's almost what you seem to be... I mean, there are other ways of doing it, but it's almost as if there needs to be a kind of society, the old-fashioned sense of a community group that have got... You know, they're not all the same people doing the same job, but they've got an interest in it. Because it's very early... It feels like very early days, what you're talking about.
I mean, I can certainly do some search. I mean, I don't know, Andrew, if you're aware of anything within the South Park.
I think it's quite a small community itself.
Where it overlaps well, because it then leads into the curatorial and it leads into the academic.
Yes, I
think it's become one of the things where...
Creative practitioners.
I think there are people in archaeology working on this. Actually, and because, for instance, I know at the University of York they appointed Mark Edmonds, an archaeologist, to work on the archaeology of the dye and of digital artefacts. So I think the new archaeology, because the way in which disciplines get reconfigured is interesting. So archaeology has been reconfigured to deal with some of this material. And then I sort of wonder whether we some of our conversation needs not to open up very informally, but to strategically develop so that you include multiple people from different kinds of disciplines who have an interest in digital, time-based, even live kinds of ephemeral material, and really look for their approaches.
I mean, maybe there's just some bigger existing umbrella body under which all this could be done. I mean, like the Archive Association.
Yeah, or maybe you do it through alternative network.
It was the Visual Arts Database. Visual Arts Data Center that was last year.
Yeah. What, the HDA?
We're working with them on culture. They still exist, but they're not
HRC
funded anymore.
Yeah, but they still exist, and we've got wound up with HRC. So something like that's maybe an organisation that could develop to encompass more things and more.
But not all archives are digital.
But there are other ways of doing this kind of thing, and the research that we're thinking about doing, of course, conventional outcomes like books or beyond text ideas like exhibitions. Gosh, those are the things that could very easily circulate out of an archive project, as could training. I know we don't want necessarily to use that word, but the landscape of postgraduate art education is something that can be involved in that as well, I think. So you could strategically placing artists, for instance, wouldn't it be an interesting idea just to place some very senior artists within incredibly important collections and ask them what they think? Nice thing to do.
The V&A's with the new research centre, they have rotating artists and participants who has to work the collection.
And they need to kind of keep coming back, because in a sense as well, the outcomes are what comes back out of it. Because artist residencies have a very specific, particular kind of framing as well, rather than a practice-based research.
Because I think the interesting thing is they lead to outcomes. And I think I thought the project that you were describing sounds fantastic, because it's about the process, the interaction, the experience. Mm. And that's the bit that I think is fascinating. Mm. And I feel, you know, the understanding of that will lead to so much more in terms of...
Yes, and I think that, I mean, sometimes outcomes can be quite disappointing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And actually what we want to focus on is that process.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be a question of working out a way that process could be documented and presented in itself as an outcome.
Well, I actually think it's very interesting to hear Nigel, because there's actually a sort of slightly shadow economy of the AHRC, because what they say they want to do, for instance, is to deal with process, and to not to deal with outcomes, but to deal with knowledge transfer and dissemination. Now, that may now be being interpreted, if you like, as what are you going to do and what's your outcome going to be. But
that was impact. It's now shifted to
it's
impact.
It's shifted to impact.
Now, process could be really good for impact, because you could say that we've learned from that,
and you can transfer knowledge.
Here's the advice, here's the transfer. Mm.
And that knowledge transfer can be couched in many different ways. Mm. So knowledge transfer could be, let's just be really speculative, knowledge transfer could be couched as a curated room in which everybody has an opportunity to engage for 5 minutes with somebody who's been on his research project, who talks to you, tells you a story. Mm-hmm. In other words, artists...
Speed dating.
It might be worth involving the National Archive in this discussion, because they are extremely open in my experience to... in innovative ways of getting people involved.
Who is it, the National Archive?
Who is it?
Yeah, who are the, when you say they're interested?
Well, they have independent research organisation status. So they're recognised by the AHRC as being a body that can initiate research projects by themselves. Mm-hmm. Somebody called Nancy Bell is the person I've done quite a lot of business with. But I mean, they are very open to, as we're inviting people in and working with them, which is kind of not what you'd expect somehow. Yeah. You'd expect them to be rather.
Well, certainly I heard the presentation, I mean, I had personal links, and I was very impressed with it, very open, very accessible, very.
Well, the new chief executive, I think, has set a pattern there.
Yeah.
Mm. And they would be. They would be a fantastic organisation to have such placements and experiments going on then, because they've got, you know, in terms of national projects, they've got some of the most important archival runs you could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can sort of do it there, then you can do it anywhere.
Thinking about archives. Mm-hmm. David and Steve, with the longevity and success of the British Artists Film and Video Study Collection, now thinking as well about where that goes and what kinds of things are next. And then immediately from this very small research centre, Steve and Chris deciding that we would like to really curate a room of conversation in which we would have a sort of responsibility to participants to kind of really think about how we might go with, where we might go with collaborative research.
Mm-hmm.
So this day has those kinds of functions, I think, for us, and that's it, really.
Mm-hmm.
Again, open-ended. I mean, I keep saying we need to do to get something out of it, but, you know, for me...
It's worth just sort of as an anecdote, because we've had conversations about this, and we also both came in at when it was still forming in Ireland. And one of my strongest memories of working here has been that I wasn't completely sure what fine art research was, but I knew what the Artist Film and Video Studies Centre was.
Yeah.
So we managed to hold on to that, because that was doing something which we recognised as important and valuable. And yes. somehow a slightly different model to the other kinds of research practices that are slightly, which are being driven really by the AHRC. So
mm.
I think it's good to have, to keep that initiative. Really.
I think so. And perhaps just to simply know what the questions are, really, rather than the answers. Like, I don't know what final practice-based research is at all, but as I feel getting to the starting point is perhaps more important than finding a prescriptive answer to that question. But artists can make experiments into that, and this is about thinking about where, how we can work with artists' extant work, artists as scholars, artists as archivists. I mean, thinking about the Julian Studio as well. And how artists' practice might actually inform scholarship. Because, you know, artist practice-based research, even though we've got that term now, we still tend to think of that as making an artwork. But maybe it isn't to do with making an artwork. On it, you know, that's not the only thing artists' practice-based research does. I mean, Felicity's example about the APG is an example of artist practice-based
and
research.
And if you were to contact Barbara Stavini,
mm.
who's one half of the originator of the artist present group, she will do a fantastic performance.
Yeah.
I am an archive,
that's right. Yeah. That's the next actually should be. Yes. And I think she's part of this Tate, isn't she, with Mia White? She's connected.
Yes, she's gonna yes, she'll be part of it if we get
the money. She'll probably be performing live an archive
yes,
at the Tate.
So. No, she's very important, obviously.
Yeah. Shall we stop there and have a cup of tea and then
yes.
and then what do we go to conclude for
well,
the day?
I mean, one of the things that we talked about
yes.
briefly earlier, I mean, as very much doubt that Pete's going to might turn up at the end of the day, but we were going to have Pete Cornwell here who was going to be talking about very specific archive collection projects that he's been involved with at ZKM, Montevideo, and the whole way of thinking much more in terms of the kind of equipment resource that we might be developing to link in with networks and so on.
Sustainability
beyond that. I was suggesting to Claire that maybe we should keep the momentum of this going and perhaps have another meeting say a month or so, depending on people's availability, and Pete can then present whatever it was that he was going to present today about that. And we can use that as the jumping off point for some more conversation.
We certainly could keep in touch with everybody and organise an event, whoever can come and more people into that conversation. I think that's a really good idea.
And I mean, I think sort of keeping this going as a kind of informal series would be really useful for keeping the conversation going. If not identifying outcomes, at least identifying processes.
And also perhaps then trying to identify real things that one can really do.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether or not they're outcomes, but whether perhaps we call them interventions or something else.
Hmm? Interrogations.
Interrogations.
I'll stop here.
Really. I think I used the word interrogate earlier.
I've only not
played you that. When I first came to it, I was talking to David, I remember this conversation I had with you, where we talked about words that enter into particular ages. I don't know if you remember this, I said that the word of the late 60s and 70s was soft. There was soft machine, there was like soft frames on artworks, there was soft sculpture.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting, soft ice cream probably came in. And it's very interesting to think about, some of the words, the hard-edged words that have come into the 90s. We might actually go back to the soft. There was something about that whole thing, soft sculpture has just gone out of the window. Nobody makes it anymore. Because we don't have
what
a word.
What is it made from?
God, I don't know,
felt.
It's sort of foam.
Yeah, and carpet.
And carpet.
It's really awful, isn't it?
But, do you know what I mean? The whole notion of the words
touch,
that we've started to use, and
used some quite provocative ones today. I think that they are really interesting in terms of how we get people to think about what's informing the research. Really.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the fact that we're talking about experimentalism in a sense and process, and earlier I went in my presentation, I used the word, you know, the kind of non-teleological, naturalistic kind of approach to research. I think all these things have a kind of common thread in that.
Yeah.
It's not soft, but it's
something else. Associative,
kind of generous.
Crunchy.
Crunchy, yeah, chewy.
But actually, they are quite important in thinking about how all kinds of
how language evolved, which culture. I think it's kind of high fiber, isn't it? High fiber. Well, not chewy, high fiber. Okay, on that note, and have a more informal discussion.
But I certainly think that we don't want to just leave it there. We want to really start to generate ideas. Plus, also, it might be important to say that we partly are being driven by the fact that we do have quite a lot to offer between us at the moment. We have this important amount of kit. We have a commitment to artist practice-based research. And so if anybody wants to actually talk to Steve or David or myself, and I'm sure they will talk to Campbell as well, it's at Lux Online, then we're available to be talked to about this project. And to Andrew, particularly. Or to Nigel, actually. We'll take some notes on that. But thank you all very much.
Actually, it was quite a special
thing to be able to have a discussion that is so open-ended in a very effective way.
Yes, and thank you, Claire, for leading us through it.
Yeah, thank you.
And also thank you, Chris, for all the background organisation.
Yeah.
All that. Great. Yeah. Good.
Thank you.